All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum.
Stay on target.
Maximum. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome once again to the Read Rothbard podcast. This is a very special episode, not like the Special Olympics episode. This one is special because of the person in the room with me.
Hey guys, it's me. I'm actually went to tremendous effort to drive hundreds and hundreds of miles to come all the way to have slightly better audio recording and to hang out with my buddy and to waste a whole bunch of time before we actually got around to doing this.
Yeah, and the better audio quality is a maybe at this point. We've been fussing around with this thing pretty much all morning, trying to get it to work right. Trying to find the extra set of headphones, and once I finally found it after an hour, they're like, fuck it, let's just plug the mic in, no headphones, let's just bare bones it, and let's do this.
So, is this going to work or not? Probably.
Probably. We got a couple of beers, and we're up to no good. Making trouble in the neighborhood.
Yeah, so you got some housekeeping for him, Daniel?
I do, yeah. So like I said, Read Rothbard podcast, in case it didn't come through clearly. We are at episode 16, but 17th episode posted, and so we are at the limit for how much we can have hosted at one time, so you will start to see things drop off of the Podomatic stream. You can find it always on the readrothbard.com website, so if you want to go back in the archives, you can find it. I've got the audio loaded up as a download, so it won't play from there. You can download it and then play it in your player of your choosing. It'll just be an MP3 file. Beyond that, other housekeeping items,
you got email addresses.
You got email addresses. So, now it's just Robert@readrothbard.com, or if you prefer, Daniel@readrothbard.com.
But why would you?
And maybe we should have a conjoined twin account so that, if someone wants to bitch at both of us at the same time, I mean, they could just CC.
Uh-huh.
But we could have a garbage collector box.
Just like. Yeah, bitching at readrothbard.com.
Yeah, or moan at readrothbard.com.
Complaints, suggestion box.
We'll work on it. We'll work on that.
Yeah.
So this is also another relatively timely episode. So just this week, an actor who we grew up watching has recently died. Gene Wilder, he was 83. He died on Monday of this week. And so we're posting the show on Friday of the week. And it's a mystery onto when we recorded this. We'll just leave that to be a mystery. Somewhere in between the two, though, those two extremes. And, so he died. And as a way of kind of remembering him, we looked back on some of the movies that he had done and decided to do a show about one of his films. So, Robert, take it away, man.
Yeah, so we looked at his body of work, and he did a lot of strong movies. I mean, stuff with Mel Brooks. Young Frankenstein, and on some classic stuff. I'm less of a fan of his later work. I'd say the quality dropped off a bit. I don't know what's going on with him and what eventually happened with him, but some of that early stuff was really, really good, really, really strong. Of course, everybody recognizes him being paired up with old Richard Pryor, and their partnership throughout the years led to some pretty good stuff, and including the movie that we talk about, because although Pryor wasn't in this movie, he actually has a writing credit on it. He, along with four other guys, basically took a story idea from one of the writers and hammered it into a classic script of Blazing Saddles. And that's what we watched last night. Daniel splurged for the non-HD version. And we enjoyed that grainy footage. So that was really exciting.
It really doesn't make a difference. Not a movie that old.
It was fine. It was fine. It looked fine. The jokes all came through. Although Dan likes to watch it with subtitles on. So before a joke would come through verbally, there would be the joke along the screen. So it would like ruin every punchline, which is fine. I've seen the movie before.
Yeah, but you know, with two young kids and them screaming at us wanting attention, it's really hard to hear what's going on in the movie. So that's why we have the words on. And it gives them an opportunity to visually learn how to read. You know, like they see the words, they hear the words. So when they use the N-word that many times, or fuck or shit or whatever, my kids will now probably repeat that. You know, they've got one little girl, a friend in the neighborhood, who would probably be quite offended with the N-word. I'll just put it that way.
So yeah, Blazing Saddles, if you don't know, is filled with all kinds of probably non-PC stuff. A lot of non-PC language, a lot of racial epithets thrown about all over the place, right in your face, making fun of it the whole time. And we came across some people talking about it in reviews from 15 years ago, saying how it couldn't be made then, definitely couldn't be made now.
Yeah, it'd be a hate film.
Yeah, and at the time, the studio pushed back on getting rid of all the curse words, getting rid of all the offensive language, and they basically said, well, what do you want, like a 9-minute film? So it is really filled with it.
So speaking of trains, the movie is based on trains.
Yeah, so it's a land deal.
Yeah,
scam.
Do a synopsis here. Give us the rundown.
All right, what do I think the story is in this movie?
Yep.
It's a very loosely held plot. It's not... The plot is kind of secondary to the jokes. The original idea for the movie was 1974 and 1874. And they really kind of just went from there. So the movie goes, there's a corrupt lieutenant governor. Is that who Hedley Lamarr is? I think he's like a lieutenant associate governor or something like that.
He has a long, like, dripping title of corruption.
Yeah. So Hedley Lamarr is the name of the character. I can't remember the name of the guy. But he's like this corrupt lieutenant governor or whatever, and he wants the land that is going through this town of Rockridge because they're going to be putting the railroad through it, or they want the town land so that they can put the railroad through it or whatever. So what does he do? He decides to get a bunch of thugs and villains and toughs and sends them in to beat up the residents and to basically scare him out of town. And when that doesn't work the first time, he decides to hire a black sheriff to scare them out of town. Because if they're not afraid of thugs, they'll be afraid of having this black guy be the law figure in the town.
Or just be so disgusted.
Right. Just want to leave. So it backfires on him, though, because it turns out the sheriff, the new sheriff guy, kind of gets behind the town, helps them fight off this corruption and the thugs and whatnot. That's basically the plot. Various hijinks ensue. The ending is quite unlike pretty much most movies, where it kind of gets meta, and they end up fighting off like on the Hollywood set.
Yeah, they break the fourth wall?
Yeah, they break the fourth wall, and so now they're not just in this Wild West town. They're in Hollywood, and they're actors making the movie. And then they actually go, and they kind of, like, is a preview to the joke in Spaceballs when they're, like, watching Mr. VCR, the movie being made. They actually go to the movie theater where it's playing Blazing Saddles, and they sit in the theater, and they see what's happening in the movie, and they're like, oh, shit, the bad guy's right outside the theater, because we're inside watching movie, and there he is. So then they go back outside, and of course he shoots him and kills him, and they drive off into the sunset in like this 1970s style black car
Yeah, well, they ride off on their horses.
And then they get off the horses.
And then they get in this limo.
Yeah.
And then it's the end of the movie. And yeah, when it ended, I was like, I laughed a lot. It was hilarious. But it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
No.
The plot was pretty sad. I think it was just whatever they could use as a vehicle to get the jokes out there. And not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, it's probably better than most of the movies that come out these days. And I think this is one of those classics, which is why I was willing to splurge on it, you know, using that Amazon Prime instant video stuff, which, you know, if you click on the link, folks, you support us. So, you know, if you want to watch this movie as well, go ahead and click down below and buy it. But you were mentioning the land deals. So it's reminiscent of there's a lecture Murray did about railroads and the history of economic growth in the United States. And I'll plug it in right here.
First of all, like, again, as we'll see in more detail later, as we go along, he gave them a huge amount of loans, interest-free loans, heavy subsidies per mile of track, and cash, plus huge amount of land, and 20 miles, every mile, alternate 20 mile sections, 20 square mile sections, which would mean something like 4.5 miles, whatever, about 4.5 miles in each, but an alternate section, so it means you can't do very much in here. In addition to that, the government, this is bad enough, and such a huge subsidy here. Also, of course, this becomes the most, first of all, they gave the railroads the best land in the West. Second of all, in addition to giving them all this land, they closed, the government, U.S. government closed for settlement all land on each side up to about 60, sometimes 100 miles. Closed off. Nobody was allowed to settle. To 100 miles on either side of the track. So in other words, obviously everybody wants to get to the railroad station because that's the, you know, not much going on the West here except the railroad. And the rest of this is Indian country or whatever, or barren. So this becomes the choicest land. The government closed the door for settlement, didn't allow anybody to settle any place except buying land from the railroads. In other words, railroads get this free land from the government and then resell it to the settlers at a high price, essentially a monopoly price, so to speak. Especially because the government kept out of settlement for many years. Everything on each side for many miles, 80 miles or so on each side of the railroad. Fantastic subsidization. And this, because of this, an enormous amount of cookery also took place. In addition to this boodle, what is often called the robber barons came in. The robber barons were really, the robbery came about because it was an open channel by the federal government. As we'll see how that was done. The amount of there's differences of, you know, whichever place you go to get the data, how many millions of miles of acreage was handed out by the federal government to the railroads. I guess it depends on which, some of it was given back and stuff. It was around 220 million acres. Enormous amount. Especially considering, as I say, no, the other land wasn't worth much and a huge amount, much more than that, was kept out of circulation for many years. Forcing people, if they want to get on this thing, to settle to buy land at a high price from the railroad. As a result of this and other things, we'll see as we go along, the farmers begin to start griping about the railroads. And the thing is, the later gripes are much more irrational. Later gripes are the freight rates were too high, which they obviously weren't, and they were falling all the time. But the basic gripes came about by the 1870s, by the late 1860s, early 1870s, this so-called anti-monopoly movement among the Western farmers. Well, they had a very good grievances. They had all this land was being kept out of circulation. Railroad had this free gift of land, and all this land was held out of circulation, and this land was untaxed by the local government. So he had set up a local government. The railroad land was tax-exempt, even while being held out of circulation. So naturally, I don't blame the farmers for griping. I'd be griping, too. So it wasn't a socialistic or statist type of gripe, the anti-monopoly movement. It was really essentially an attack on railroad privileges.
And so, you know, that's the Murray bit on that, and it'll have been plugged in, and then you know, now we're back. We're live. Murray, thank you for that.
Okay, so I've got a few questions for you, Daniel. Recently, when I was doing some research into answering some statist questions about anarchy, specifically who would build the roads, I was looking at some articles. We can post these, get the links when I get back home. But they brought up the idea that private companies actually, as an argument for anarchy, the private companies were actually very successful in making railroads and having them be profitable. Because one of the big arguments is that, well, there's no reason a private company would build a road because it wouldn't be profitable enough. There's no incentive to do that. And then the anarchist response was, well, private companies built a railroad. They were able to. So are you saying that that's not the case?
Yeah, I'm saying that the railroads, despite being given this 10 or 20 year bonanza of free shit and restriction on supply for competing alternatives, all of them went bankrupt except for a handful. And they had essentially monopoly powers in their area. And their rates were super high and their service was pretty poor.
All these railroads were very inefficient, you have to realize. They were run badly, but nobody cared about how they were run. They would just want to fleece it as much as possible. And that, from an engineering point of view, they're all in terrible shape. From an entrepreneurial point of view, they're in terrible shape. So here's Cook trying to get loans, and bingo comes the panic of 1873. And which was, much of which was brought about by Cook's own inflationary manipulations through the banks and the government bonds, etc. Cook goes bankrupt. It's one of the great pieces of poetic justice ever. Going bankrupt at your own creation, more or less. In other words, here he is. He's responsible for Northern Pacific's overextension. He's responsible for the inflationary boom of the late 60s and early 70s. He's responsible for the big public debt, which comes in, and the whole bank credit expansion. And when the collapse comes, as it always does come, he gets it in the neck. It was the end of Jay Cook. The fall of the House of Cook, as it was called. Okay, so all these, Villard, after Cook goes bankrupt, Villard becomes head of Northern Pacific and tries to run it, and doesn't do very well. It's finally, again, the costs are excessive and so forth. By this time, by 1873, with 1872, 1873, is the end of the railroad land grants. I mean, that's it. With the end of the Grant administration, with a panic, the massive land grants are over. So now Northern Pacific has to sort of make it on its own. It couldn't do it. And it goes bankrupt around the late 70s. And, you know, it goes into bankruptcy. Of course, the bankruptcy in the case of railroad doesn't mean the whole track is destroyed. It means the whole reorganization and whatever.
But there were some heroic figures. I think James J. Hill was one of them. He built the Great Northern without any government help, without any government land, and he outcompeted these government-funded babies and forced them to improve their service, improve their technology, lower their prices.
So it can be done.
It can be done, yeah, absolutely. The free market folks went in and smashed them. There was another guy, I think his name was Jay Gould, and his shtick was to buy a struggling railroad and then cut their rates. Because there were all these cartels of the competing companies, and they would get together and say, okay, here's what the rates are going to be. And we're going to base it on how much, how long your railroad is, or how much it costs to run your railroad, or how much grade you have to go up, or whatever. And they all wanted their own, they all wanted it tipped in their favor to improve the amount of the percentage they could do and earn money on. And so they'd always be fighting each other to come to these agreements. And then 6 months later, they'd break them. You know, they'd start silently cutting rates so they wouldn't announce their rates publicly or whatever the public rates were. They were super high. And then they would give like sweetheart deals to people, like people who moved a lot of product. They'd say, okay, you get like half off. But don't tell anyone because then I'm breaking the cartel agreement. And so that, you know, that was kind of like how it operated. But Jay Gould would buy these struggling ones and then just cut their rates. He would just disregard
the previous agreements.
They had the cartel agreements. Because they get broken anyway. Because in a free market,
right,
if you
not
can't enforce
public,
it.
They're not contract based. They're just some backroom sweet deal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And if they're not government enforced, there's no way to hold them together. You know, because every time they're doing something, they're adapting and they want more of that pie, and they're looking at it as a finite pie. It's a mindset thing, you know, and they're looking to government to like enforce it. And so, yeah, these guys would buy struggling railroads or just build a completely different one and just outcompete them. Just cut the rates, do better service, be faster, whatever it is. And so it's James J. Hill and Jay Gould. And I can plug in another Murray clip because he talks about it for a long time. So the previous Murray clip might have been 5-10 minutes. There's one on Jay Gould and James J. Hill. It'll be another 5-10 minutes. So we'll plug it in here.
Coming in, the last transcontinental railroad to make it, doing it purely with almost without any government subsidy at all, certainly with no grants, no loans, or all the rest of it, really heroic action. This was the so-called Great Northern, which started up in Duluth, Minnesota, way up in northern Minnesota, and skirted the Canadian border, sometimes on the American side, sometimes the Canadian side, something like that, and comes into Seattle. And notice all these, even though there are only a few transcontinental railroads, they all compete with each other. If you're going to send shipments out the coast to the west coast or over to the east, you can take any one of these routes. And so they're all really in competition. So, of course, this is called the Great Northern. The Great Northern is completed around the 1870s, I believe, and it was, of course, mostly in competition with Northern Pacific. And this was organized and by an entrepreneur was James J. Hill, the last of the great railroad magnates. Hill is a very interesting character. He's one of these people who fit the complete Horatio Alger picture, which is the so-called stereotype, Horatio Alger stereotype. He was born in Canada, poor. He was born in a log cabin. He was actually born in a log cabin, which is not something, even though it sounds great, it's not something to really hope that you're born in. He came from a Scotch-Irish farm in Ontario. He became a clerk. He was uneducated. Most of these people are uneducated. He becomes a clerk. Comes to the age of 18. Emigrates to St. Paul, Minnesota, and starts buying out small bankrupt railroads, and starts integrating them and making them more efficient. He's an extremely efficient construction person. He started his first railroad called the St. Paul, Minnesota, Manitoba Railroad, a small railroad. What he went for, I think he was also short and thin. A lot of these guys are quite short, otherwise, these big entrepreneurs then. Rockefeller was quite, was very short. I mention that because there are not too many short entrepreneurs these days. They were short. At any rate, he specializes in low rates, cheap freight rates. First, freight is the big thing. The passengers are, from an economic point of view, didn't mean much for these companies. And a large volume and being competitive. And so he's very efficient. He's a very efficient railroad. He's always out-competed North Pacific. It made good profits. It was extremely, there was no phony construction company. The whole thing was on the up and up. It's kind of a heroic thing, James J. Hill. And so it's a good counter image. And he encouraged immigration, but he was there. He knew the area. He raised wheat in this area in Manitoba. He knew, you know, what the climate was like. So he didn't have to lie to the public because he was actually there. None of these guys, these pamphleteers, were somewhere sitting in Philadelphia. They didn't know what's going on in the Northwest. So at any rate, the idea is to try to, so what Jay Gould would do, he would buy a railroad and start going down his elastic demand curve and picking up all these great sales and making enormous profits. Boy, was he hated. It's very much like unionists hate strike breakers, call them scabs because their unions are trying to raise the wage rate, keep other employees out. The people they hate the most is not the employers, but the non-union people who take the jobs of the strikers. Same way, people in other manufacturers or other railroad people hate most of the other railroad men or other manufacturers who break the cartel agreement. That was Gould's function. He looked for a good high-profit place. He figured out the high profit to do an agreement. He'd nip in there, buy the railroad, and undercut them. Magnificent. He was called the disturber of the peace. Because he competed. And His whole career was out of breaking rate agreements of this sort. He'd go in, he'd buy a railroad, undercut, smash the agreement, smash the cartel, and clean up. He did it when he was in charge of Union Pacific. He bought Union Pacific during the 1870s. Did it there. And of course, in the long run, he benefited the railroads because it meant that they had to compete. They had to lower their costs. If the price goes down, the price is cut, it means that they have to make shape up, lower their costs, get rid of waste and that sort of stuff. But of course, they didn't like to be shaped up in that way, as you can imagine. And there's a great character, hated by everybody. The consumers didn't appreciate him either. They didn't understand what was going on. Of course, they liked the rate cuts, but they didn't understand that he was different from the other so-called robber barons. And look at Gould. He was, again, a self-made man. He fit the image of Hill. He also Carnegie and Rockefeller later on. These people were all born with nothing. They had no capital. Parents were quite poor, born in upstate New York. He was short, 5 foot tall, Jay Gould, short and thin. of course, everybody was shorter in that period, but that was unusually short. Didn't have an average of 5 foot. This is a height theory of history I keep coming up with here. He was self-taught, of course, he didn't go to college. None of these guys went to college. By the way, it's another thing, the whole college nonsense. In the United States in that period, very few people went to college. And the people didn't seem to suffer from not going to college. They started working at the age of 12 or whatever it was, and by the age of 20, they could be millionaires. The rest of the people were slogging away from college. I'm not knocking college per se. You have to realize there's another side of this picture. You waste a lot of time in college. He was a self-taught surveyor. He started as a railroad surveyor, and he started speculating. He was frail also. He was half dead most of the time. And he was a great corporate financier. He saw the rates, you know, he started maneuvering with that. He plowed back profits. He was cool, detached, emotionless, all that sort of stuff. These are all the stereotypes that Jay Gould. He's a great guy. I love him. And he benefited consumers, he benefited the industry, and he made a lot of enemies along the way. God bless him.
See? Murray's great, isn't he? He knows the shit.
He probably does.
He probably does. So a little bit about the Blazing Saddles and the land arrangement. Like, he was going to make money because that land was going to become valuable, and there's going to be a restriction on the other land available to anyone else, so the supply would be cut, and he wanted to drive the people who live there out. So he hired that gang, and he had a whole long list of people who could be in the gang. Some of them were like 1945 Germans. Some of them were KKK. Some of them were like Roman centurions. There's some Arabic dudes on a camel. It's just this big list.
And this is a long history in Hollywood filmmaking of having there be a land deal at the heart of the story. There's another Western called Once Upon a Time in the West, Sergio Leone movie.
A
spaghetti Western. And it's exactly the same deal. Land deal, railroad coming through, gonna build a whole town around this railroad, and it's the same deal. And also, what, every Superman movie with Lex Luthor? They're all land deals.
That sounds like, you know, it could be Donald Trump, right? He's the land deal, making deals.
Deals.
Making the deals.
So, one of the characters in Blazing Saddles, actually the bad kind of henchman dude, is named Taggart, and I know you wanted to. It might be an homage to the Dagny Taggart Railroad people, maybe. Could be.
It could be, yeah. I mean, you look at Brooks, Mel Brooks, and he has sort of this quip type of take on authority and politicians. He makes them dummies and corrupt and sex-addled.
Right. He always plays the president or the governor, and he's always a real moron. And even in Blazing Saddles, he admits, we got to do something about it to keep our phony baloney jobs. And then Spaceballs, he's this totally stupid, sex-addicted retard. And, yeah.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if he hadn't read some Ayn Rand and they plugged in the Taggart name because it was associated with railroads.
Yeah, could be.
You know, just as a little... I mean, it was the first thing that jumped out to me when I was watching the film last night. What was the name? Taggart? Oh, Dagny Taggart, of course.
Right. Could be.
You were mentioning Westerns, and one of the
trivia things I just saw was that he has this little two-shot Derringer pistol, has two barrels.
Yep.
And in the film, he shoots it three times without reloading.
Does he?
And it's, I guess, supposed to be funny because they do that in those Westerns all the time. It's, you know, in every action movie, it's like they never fucking reload, right? It's like infinite gun.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I thought that was funny.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Very subtle.
Well, and it plays into the idea that every gun is some sort of a automatic assault weapon. Which is clearly not.
This lawnmower of death.
Well, yeah, if you got a pistol that holds six shots and you can shoot it infinitely, okay, maybe. Not the case.
Yeah,
there's the case.
It's funny how the movies will get made that way, and the guns will be either automatic or unlimited ammunition. And yet the liberals, who are, you know, most of them in Hollywood are probably that way. I mean, even Matt Damon and the Jason Bourne movies, and we'll be doing those in the future episodes. But he went out recently and said, he was in Australia, and he's like, you know, I wish we could do what you did here about guns in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, he's making films where all he does is run around with guns, unlimited guns, unlimited ammo.
Right, where he's using guns to solve problems.
Yeah, it's like
defend himself.
Yeah, which is apropos because he wants the state to do everything, which is, you know, you boil it down, that's what it is, right?
Yeah. You're
using guns to solve problems or attempt to solve problems and just create more.
Right.
Worse problems and initiating all this violence. All right, let's bring it back to Blazing Saddles. Is there anything else you want to mention about it? We talked about Richard Pryor. He was one of the writers, and
they wanted him in the movie
to be the Black Bart.
Right, but he was seen as unreliable. They actually called him at one point, and they're like, Richard, can you come in? He's like, no, I'm in Canada or whatever. He's like, why are you in Canada? I was like, oh, I met some girls, and now I'm in Canada.
And he had quite the...
he's like, I need some money to come back home.
The freebase cocaine issue, right?
Yeah, he was well into the drugs, although he wasn't quite a big star yet, and probably his stardom... anyway. But we could talk about how this movie couldn't be made today, and the PC police going on, and maybe we could somehow merge that into a talk on cultural appropriation. What even the hell that is?
Okay, yeah. So we mentioned this a little bit earlier, I think, but there was a documentary made about this film from 2000, 2001, and the film's from 1974. It was probably the 25th anniversary or whatever it is. And at the time, Mel Brooks was saying, oh, yeah, there's no way you could make this movie today, 2001 time, because we say the N-word 100 times, and fuck and shit and piss and twat.
And a couple other cultural epithets or racial epithets that would not go over.
Yeah, and there's Native Americans, Indians that they say some things
Chinese
about. Chinese.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. And so, yeah, he laments that, I mean, there's no way you could make it today. And you know, even back when it was made, the studio said, you know, cut out most of it, right? It's a 90-minute movie. It would have been a 9-minute movie.
And they even, from when they edited it for TV, which I can't even believe they even tried to show this on TV. I can't even imagine what it would be like. But they even edited out the fart scene. Like, you couldn't even have a fart scene in TV. So what they ended up doing was they cut all the fart sounds. And so all you have is just a series of cowboys kind of standing up a little bit and sitting back down.
Oh, like they're doing the wave, kind of?
They're kind of like doing the wave. It's just like this kind of choreography of cowboys kind of standing up and sitting down, and it makes no sense. So, I mean, talk about, yeah, I don't even know what the rest of the movie even looks or sounds like when they edit it for TV, but yeah, I imagine it's horribly butchered.
Yeah. Well, speaking of making no sense, so Mel Brooks said, he told this dude he would cut a bunch of stuff. He told him that he would, you know, he promised him, and then he didn't. He only cut one scene, and that scene we talked
one
about
line.
During the movie, one line.
One line.
Yeah, he still showed the scene, and cutting the line kills the joke.
Makes it dirtier.
Yeah, makes the scene way dirtier.
Yeah. So there's the female character who's like trying to seduce Black Bart, mm-hmm. and they turn off the lights, and
they're messing around.
They're messing around. You can tell they're messing around because she's making sounds like, "Oh my goodness, whatever." And then in the edited version, it just kind of ends.
She's like, oh, it's so big. It's true. It's true. You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's true what they say about black people or whatever. Yeah. And then it's over. What he ended up cutting was, he's like, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Madeir, but you're sucking on my elbow.
My arm. That's my
arm.
Which would have made the scene.
Because as is, it's not funny. And it's way dirtier. But with the edited line, yeah, it would have been way better. And he admitted that it was one of the best laughs that they had when they were watching it. So.
Yeah, and I think he said it was a mistake to cut it.
Yeah, it is. It's the movie's worse off for it.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, because that would have been hilarious.
Yeah.
And thanks to the power of the free market and the internet, we know about it. You know, it's not like the movie shows in the theater in 1974, and that's the end of it.
Right.
You know? So that's what's cool about it.
But there are a lot of classic lines from the movie. If you haven't seen it, or if you have, you're probably still familiar with some of the lines.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this movie in years, so it was definitely worth watching again as a refresher.
Yeah. Where the white woman at? we heard you was hung. You heard right. I mean, all kinds of good
Let
stuff.
Let me whip it out.
Let me whip this out.
And this is a speech or whatever. Or his declaration that he's the sheriff.
Right. So, lots of good stuff. If you haven't checked it out, check it out. It may or may not hit you in the right spot, but we enjoyed it. Although I think there are some people out there who would not enjoy it.
My wife did not.
Your wife didn't. There are many people on YouTube, many feminists, I don't think would enjoy it. If they see misogyny and racism and whatever in the most
benign thing.
Benign offenses.
What was that one that we were talking about where there was some snowplow company putting out like posts to mark where the curbs were?
Yeah, so Anarchy Ball did a response to this lady. And it might be a troll video. It might not be. I don't know. If it is, congratulations. If it isn't, it's still funny. But it's this feminist who goes to this mall parking lot and it's like cold and the snowplow company has put out all these posts marking where the
curb is.
The curb is.
Yeah, their stakes.
Right, their stakes marking where the curb is so that they can plow around it. And the girl comes up to him and is like, what's this? What's this doing here? Look at this misogyny.
Yeah, what are these, penises?
You know? And so she pulls one out in an act of defiance. And Anarchy Ball is like, well, they know it's needed to be pulled out. Thank you.
They're done plowing.
You're doing your job. Their job for them. And in the rest of the video, she's like this crazy person. I mean, the whole video, she's this crazy person. But she goes in and like accuses some post office delivery guy of following her and like stalking her. And he's like, I don't know who you are, lady. What are you talking about? If it's parody, it's not far off from the truth. Because we watched another video.
What's your name?
What's your name? This humongous video, also done by Anarchy Ball.
As we continue to fillet them.
He does some good content. So he did a response video to a lady who put out a video where she was wanting to talk to a guy who was being interviewed in some public building. And he got done with his interview and he's walking out. And she goes up to him and she's like, what's your name? And he's like, what? Who are you?
Yeah, she must have had some issue with what he had said in the interview.
Must have.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as a joke, he's like, humongous. And she's like, humongous what? Humongous what? And she says it over and over and over again. He's like, humongous. What? That's my name. Deal with it. And she's like, no, humongous what? Humongous what? And then he walks away. And then she instantly feels like I was just sexually harassed.
Yeah, so she starts chasing him.
So she starts chasing him. And then she's screaming at the top of her lungs.
Well, not yet. She's actually still relatively.
Relatively. Well,
once she gets another person to chime in, then she blows up.
She blows up, and she talks to like the security guards, the private security guards who show up, to like, lady, you need to leave the premises. She's like, did you chase after my, why are you talking to me when you could chase after the sexual harasser that just harassed me?
Well, and she said, you're not actual police, so I don't have to do anything you fucking say.
Right.
And she was a total bitch about it.
But the idea that you would go up and ask somebody a thing, and then based on their response, claim that you were assaulted, is ridiculous. Like, okay, what's your name? Big Dick. That's sexual harassment now? I've just been sexually harassed because you told me that was your name? It makes no sense.
It does make no sense. And it's not like she was there. It's not even a sense that, like, there's an employment, there's, like, a hostile work environment or whatever.
Right, so it's not like she could, like, not leave anytime.
Yeah. She had to associate with the guy. She actually initiated the conversation.
The interaction, right.
Yeah. Sorry, I called it a conversation. It's her yelling at the guy. And if anything, she's the one being belligerent and I almost want to say violent. Like, she's getting in people's faces.
Yeah, she's up in his space.
Yeah.
And if anybody's harassing anybody, it's her harassing these people. But it just shows the, I don't know, she just gets hysterical.
Yeah.
I don't know if she's ever, and then she's got people backing her up, which is amazing. I mean, yes. Maybe it's just people wanting to be supportive of their friend.
Well, the way she was portraying it, like she was the victim, like he just sexually harassed me. But of course, none of those people saw that because that didn't happen.
Right.
But they take her at face value. Like, oh, she's like crying rape. You know,
right.
Like, I want to come help.
I'm going to believe my friend. I'm going to help this person who has just been attacked. Right. Because they didn't see the whole video.
They didn't see the interaction.
Right.
But it's terrible. It's hard to watch. And Anarchy Ball actually says, that's all I can stomach. There's more, but, you know, fuck it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't blame him. It's hard to watch. It's hard to listen to these women shrieking for the sake of shrieking, to just be the victim and just love and play up that victimhood. It's just so delicious. So I really want to talk about, though, you sent me a Facebook post this morning,
as I'm apt to do,
as you do, like 4 a.m I get like a litany of Facebook posts. So I wake up and I've got this treasure trove of a couple of them to go through. And the first one, there's this a local Seattle rapper. He goes by the name of Speculation.
Spelled funky.
Yeah, it's like S-P-E-K-U-L, something, something. But I don't know how long he's been in the game. I don't know anything about him. But in the article, he says he's quitting because he claims, and the quote is something like, just by being on stage, I am aggressing. So he's saying that he wants to quit to make more room for black rappers. And we could talk about how ridiculous that is. Like, just by you doing a thing is aggression. That would be like, there's no room for black rappers because there's this white rapper. There's only a certain amount of
finite space.
There's a finite space for people to rap. Saying that you are aggressing against someone just by trying to make a living is like saying that just by selling a hamburger on a street, you are aggressing against your competitor across the street. Now, also on his reasoning, is you read the article, right?
No, I look at the headline and I know enough.
Oh, okay. All right, so this is going to be some rampant speculation here.
Well, I like how you were on the couch over here.
Yeah.
Opening up your phone, and then you see it, and you just start laughing for like a minute or two straight. Like, you couldn't even contain it. You know, it's like so fucking ridiculous. He has so much guilt about being a white person and doing, quote unquote, a black thing.
Right.
That he's self-immolating. You know, he's taking his hobby, something he's worked very hard on, and he's just throwing it away.
Yeah.
Just thrown in the trash can because, oh, I was taking a black person's space in this industry or something. It's bizarre. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's the white guilt thing. Because he's a white man and you can't be racist against him. It doesn't exist.
Right, that doesn't exist. But if we take it at the cultural appropriations angle, like he is a white man doing a black man's thing, it gets into a really sticky, kind of quagmire-y ether where, what exactly is a black man's thing? What is a white man's thing? What is anything?
Yeah, so you got to go way back.
You got to go way back.
Root words and originations and first, first person to do X.
And just because first person to do X does anything, does that mean that he has a monopoly on doing X forever? Or people of his skin color, same similar skin tone to do X forever? I mean, talk about a monopoly on anything.
Yeah.
Talk about
we're talking about Halloween and Dia de los Muertos and how people get upset now because we're stealing Halloween from Mexicans or something.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. And just on a related note, like, we had a baby carrier called a Kinder Pack, and it had sugar skulls as the pattern. And I bought it because I was like, oh, skulls. Cool, right? They happen to be Dia de los Muertos type skulls.
Yeah.
And so my wife saw other people complaining about how white people can't wear this carrier because it's cultural appropriation. We're stealing it from the Mexicans because, you know, they collectively own this
totally tangible property, aren't you? See, that's this funny thing, is that aren't you promoting such a thing?
Yeah.
Aren't you saying,
we appreciate it.
Yeah, you're celebrating this thing that somebody, this idea that somebody came up with, and you think it's a great idea, a great look, some great art, or you like rap so much that even you want to do it, you're fantastic, you're adding to the beautiful body of collected work of rap or Dia de los Muertos art or whatever.
Yeah, I remember you were into those little Milagros little animals that they make.
Yeah, that they make down in Wakata.
Yeah, the little wooden animals.
Yeah.
And you know, you're a white guy.
So, and I'm supporting a Mexican
guy.
What are you doing buying
that shit? Fucking asshole.
So here I am
supporting them.
Here I am supporting them, making them able to have that profession where they create this artwork.
Yeah, you're a market, you're buying.
So it just gets really stupid really fast. So I can't buy anything made by a black man?
Or a Chinese person.
I can only. So you're basically saying that you have to be racist. I have to look at the product made by, you know, who it was actually made by. What happens when it's made by multiple people? A variety of people, like with like diversity, like everything.
Yeah, pencil, like, you know, made by 10,000 different people around the world, all coming together in some way to create a product.
So I can't use that because there was a black man who used his labor to help make it. So I have to only use products made by white people.
But you got to bake the cake.
But I got to make the cake. It makes no sense. It quickly devolves into insanity and stupidity. So I didn't when this was first becoming a thing, I didn't believe it. I didn't understand it. First of all, it makes no sense.
And not in the we failed to understand it.
Not that I failed to understand what they're talking about, but just that what they are saying literally makes no sense.
And if they follow through with what they're saying, they could have nothing.
They could have nothing.
Because everything is...
We would all be naked, living in a hut that we ourselves had built. We'd be anarcho-primitivists.
Yeah, anarcho-primitives.
We would have... There would be no market. There would be no trade. We would all be segregated into our own little white, exact same skin tone communities, maybe. Yeah,
sorry, you're a little darker. You gotta go to village XYZ.
Sorry, you're born. Yeah, you're being a little bit too much sun. You gotta go to the next town over or whatever. It makes no sense. And so you're saying that, you know, a black person couldn't listen to Madonna or
sing non-R&B or non-hip-hop.
Right.
Or non-rap or whatever.
Right. And you have to define exactly who made what and what idea at what time. And then who's gonna enforce it all? You gotta have some massive
Gestapo, man.
Gestapo, or you could have an insidious computer program.
Let's bring it up.
That turns us all into freaking narcs on each other and gives us benefits for narking. So Daniel showed me this horrific video last night, and it was by far the most disturbing thing I've seen in a long time.
I made sure to show it to you right before you went to bed.
Which is fantastic.
Thank you.
She
had the nightmares.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's this Chinese conglomerate that owns like Riot Games and Activision Blizzard and some other popular video game makers worldwide. Riot Games owns League of Legends, Blizzard is World of Warcraft and Overwatch and those sort of popular games, which millions of people the world over play.
Way to flex the nerd cred.
Yeah, you got it.
By the way.
What's up? I bring it.
He's got the glasses on and everything, folks.
Yeah, and we were talking about like Marvel movies last night. We might bring that into the podcast, and I could really flex my nerd shit there. So I don't remember the name of the company, but we can provide a link in the description. It's really well made little video. It's a single source, so I don't know the veracity
extra
of it.
Extra credits.
It's extra credits, and they're kind of a video game content channel on YouTube.
We'll post it below.
But it's this Chinese conglomerate that is working hand in hand with the Chinese government to make this thing called Sesame Credit. Now, this is sort of a social media platform where, as opposed to the stick, where you're punished for doing certain behavior in society.
Like with the police state,
like some sort of police state crackdown, dystopian nightmare. This is the opposite, at least initially, where you are granted benefits for being a good little citizen, by being a good little bootlicker, by posting positive comments about some government policy.
Or reading news stories that are from the state-sponsored media or not. Or purchases or
making
all these
purchases,
things.
Right. Purchases that are whatever.
Deemed necessary by the state.
You know, yeah, or are Chinese-made as opposed to importing, like, something from another country.
So they're basically gamifying how much
of a good little,
of a slave you are.
Good little slave. So
like you get a higher score and you get some like faster internet
or
travel
some
visa.
Discount or travel visa or yeah, your paperwork might go through a little bit faster. And then on the opposite side of it, if you are say instead posting negative comments
or like this podcast
or this podcast, you would get docked and you can go down into like, you know, zeros and get a super low score and then your paperwork might not go through. Your
internet would be slow.
Internet, yeah, would be slow or what have you.
Get paid less, whatever it is.
Any kind of negative actions. And the really sick part, as if that wasn't terrible enough, the really sick part is that your score is dependent upon your friend's scores.
Yeah, those in your network.
So if your friend is posting a bunch of crap that's like freedom, you know, I don't like violence, I like freedom, their score is going to go down, and that's going to negatively impact your score. And you can see that as a user instantly at any time. You can just be like, well, why is my score going down? I'm being a good little slave. Oh, it's Robert. He's put out a new episode of the Reed Rothbard podcast, and his score went down, and thereby it negatively affects my score, which negatively affects this state government-granted benefit that I was going to get. And I really had my sights set on a discount on this car that I wanted to buy, and this asshole is talking about freedom, and he's ruining my sweet stuff I was going to get. So I'm going to unfriend him or whatever.
Well, that's not even, like, initially they probably try to dissuade you, to re-educate you,
mm-hmm.
before they disassociate. Like, this is
right,
sort of
right.
Like
yes. So this person would go, hey, Robert, what the hell are you doing, man?
Yeah, you're fucking it up.
You're fucking up my shit. So get your shit together. And be a good little slave.
It's the prisoners policing the prisoners.
Absolutely. It's the panopticon where the jailer is your next-door neighbor and your friends and your online community.
Yeah, but it's this gamified thing, and it's sold as this innocuous, great thing.
And it's completely voluntary now to opt in, and the early adopters are probably going to be talking it up and getting everybody all hyped for it.
All sorts of extra benefits.
All the extra benefits for the early adopters. But apparently in 2020, it becomes mandatory. And you can imagine... And this is just version 1.0, so you can imagine what the version 2.0, version 3.0 enforcement details. I mean, you could, who knows, maybe it comes to a point where, this is China we're talking about here, so...
No human rights violations
no
there.
No human rights violations there. I mean, no one-child policies there, so...
60 million dead.
So maybe when you get to be a good little citizen, they're like, oh, well, you can have two kids now. Or maybe when you get down to zero, you're like, well, now you can't have any kids. Or maybe you just the Gestapo comes straight to your door and shoots you in the head.
Yeah, they know who to come for.
Absolutely. They know who the dissidents are. They know who the people who don't agree with the party politics. China has a horrific record of murdering people who are against the current political regime, whatever you happen to be. And that's true of all political regimes, essentially, but especially true in the collectivist socialist paradise that is China and USSR and things like that.
Yeah, so this seems like a really big one to talk about. So I'm thinking that maybe we can reference this in a future episode, perhaps that, what's that movie called? The Justin Timberlake vehicle?
In Time.
In Time, that's right. Because that could be like what version 10.0 of this thing might be, right?
Could be.
Where you have a life meter and you know, you're a good citizen, you get more credits to like live longer, and if you're a bad citizen and your life meter goes down,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's some scary shit right there.
Sure.
And that would just be, once it's adopted, it's as easy as changing a few, you know, things of code, right? Like,
yeah. Once it's in, the mandatory. And
it's a foot in the door.
Everybody's in. And at first, everybody's all, yay, go, go. This is cool. I'm getting free stuff. You know, this is fantastic. And then all they have to do is, yeah, change a line of code, change what the rewards versus the punishments are. And all of a sudden, you're living in the panopticon with everybody policing everybody else, and it could be...
Absolute control.
Absolutely 100% control. So you don't just have to look out for cops. You got to look out for literally anybody else in the world.
And it's kind of already like that. Like, we've talked about a couple of things in past episodes where...
Like
people,
the Matrix?
Yeah, where people will say something even mildly questioning laws or the state or whatever, and people would just pounce on
them. Right, like your friend that
about the state tax holiday, and that other guy who he questioned that there could be negative consequences to laws. He posted some article about it.
Yeah.
And people started calling him a libertarian as an epithet.
Right.
And he took offense to it.
Right. How dare you, sir? Call me a libertarian.
You asshole.
For questioning, mildly questioning, one tiny little sliver of government policy. The most benign complaint. And you get called some sort of an epithet, which I would take as a point of pride. Now, as a user, is it, you know, I suppose Alex Jones might say that China is just a testing ground for the things that will be adopted. I mean, this is a conglomerate that owns, you know, companies that interact worldwide. I mean, there's no sense to say that this couldn't be adopted worldwide.
Like Alibaba's part of it. These game companies, I mean, they could throw it out into the PC and console games on some level.
Yeah, you could get benefits in game.
Oh, they already do.
They already do that, but they could get, you know, this could be another thing that would provide benefits in game, and it could work across all your games.
Mm-hmm.
Like you already get like little things like bonuses like on Google Play or PlayStation,
trophies
in the Xbox games,
extra powers, whatever.
Right. So this could be benefited world or implemented worldwide. Now, I obviously would be probably opt out and just let the thugs be thugs. But say that somehow it's tied into your Google account or whatever, I would take it as a point of pride to have the lowest score possible. And I would negatively chide all the people that have positive scores, calling them bootlickers and every other name under the sun.
Well, then you'd be using the left liberal tactics, just name calling.
Well,
but you know, it's effective.
Fits.
It's effective.
You know, apparently it's effective. I want to create a negative feeling for the word status, for bootlickers, you know, spineless cowards, whatever you want to call it. So I would want to take it as a point of pride to have everybody in my circle to have the lowest scores possible. Of course, that would, you know, let people know where to find me and who to murder. But, you know, they can't kill us all, guys. And human beings have an innate sense of wanting to be free. I mean, if you ask somebody what their ideal society is, I don't think people initially say, well, top-down control, violent authority. They'll talk about people living together and being in harmony and whatever, and that is what capitalism is. It is, I mean, ANCOMs like to call it the capitalism as like this kind of authoritarian means of production, like in the hands of the few, but it is voluntary trade, absence of coercion. And that is freedom.
Well, so many people fail to see the violence that's staring them in the face. And so they think that we have, for the most part, a relatively free thing going
on.
Right,
the unseen hidden hand of violence.
Like most of us are relatively comfortable. I mean, we're in a house right now. We're in chairs. We have food.
Right, that's the status response of like, well, you're free right now, aren't you? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. But, you know, once you're aware of all the things that are bearing down on you,
mm-hmm.
it's like, there's what? Four or five devices in this room that can hear us in addition to running a podcast where they could just key in and listen.
At any time they want.
Yeah.
Like there's the Snowden movie that's coming out that it's all been admitted, but here is a movie that is hopefully refreshing everybody's memory that, yeah, the NSA, and it's probably going to be demonizing the NSA as in, like, this is one rogue agency.
Yeah,
they're getting out of control. They've overstepped their boundary a little bit. But, that is their mandate. That is their modus operandi. That is what they do. And it's not like there's always somebody listening to, but it could be turned on at any given time for the slightest whim. And maybe your score's too low, and maybe they turn on all your shit and they're listening to you big time as a potential terrorist or whatever.
Yeah, so something to think about. So I think we should start wrapping this one up. So let's talk more about this Sesame credit in a future episode about In Time, that Justin Timberlake movie. And then it sounds like if I can, I haven't gone out to see a movie in like 5 years, but I will try to see the Snowden movie because I think that would be a really good one to have a future episode about and be timely.
Yeah.
Right? 'Cause that's one of the things we're trying to figure out is a way to gain a larger audience for what we're discussing. And one of those things is seeing current movies.
As they come out.
As they come out.
And because, having content that applies to that in the same week that it comes out.
Yeah, because that's what these other guys are doing that you like.
Yeah.
They're getting all sorts of traffic. Meanwhile, we're doing movies from like 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and people are like, why are they talking about this? Who cares?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the example of my kids just, you know, focuses there, so it's really tough to get out and do it. But I think this is a movie I'll try to go see, for sure.
Yeah, it looks, hopefully it's well done, and hopefully it's, the message is that, well, we'll see what the message is.
Yeah. But hopefully it's, you know, freedom. I mean, they do show him being menaced.
Yeah.
And threatened right. by his own government.
Right.
I'll post the trailer down below. It's, you know, it's pretty good. It's compelling.
Yeah. And it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt and a bunch of other, like, big-name Hollywood guys, right? So, I mean, it looks like it's got a budget.
Yeah. And it's Oliver Stone. And he's, you know, well, he's pretty well-known for making some half-decent stuff.
Right. I mean, he made the JFK movie.
Born on the 4th of July.
Platoon. Yeah, so.
It's kind of a questioning the establishment.
You know? Yeah, although if you listen to, I recently listened to the JFK commentary.
Which is, you know, it's just terrible.
It's like, you know, 3 hours of him talking. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. But it's very much, I love my country.
That's know, why these, I made this. I thought it was important.
Yeah, these politicians are out of control. And these specific guys are bad. So it's, in that sense, it's like, eh. But it's still a well-done movie. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that he was murdered by factions within his own government. But what are you going
to do? Yeah, well, they say, like, back and to the left. Back and to the left.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of that Seinfeld. So Keith Hernandez like spits gum at them, and
that was directly made right after JFK came out.
And they do the exact, you know, line them up and back to the left.
Yep. They have the magic loogie.
Yeah, the magic loogie.
Yeah.
We'll end on a little bright note here, folks. So we are the Reed Rothbard podcast. This is the first one we've actually done together live in the same room.
That's
so
right.
Hopefully, it sounds half decent. Future episodes will be. Via some other means, previous means.
As usual.
But Robert will, in the future, have a microphone, so perhaps that'll help.
It won't help initially, but it'll help in the future.
Yeah, eventually we'll get there, when you got the bandwidth.
Yeah.
So is there anything that we want to plug at the end here? You got an update on your book? I know you said that you were still working on some stuff. You got like 80,000 pages.
85,000 words.
Oh, words. Yeah.
If I had 85,000 pages, that's like the Library of Congress.
No, that's like the amount of regulations.
There you go.
Yeah. Try to start a business, motherfucker. 80,000 pages.
And then when you can't make a profit because of all the onerous regulations and you go offshore, then they can yell at you about that.
Yeah.
You can't win.
So anyway, that's your update, right?
That's my update on the book. What I'm doing is really enjoyable, but I do have a long ways to go. I might end up staying in my cabin for another winter to finish the thing up. But when it does get born, I'll be proud as hell about it.
Yeah, I even told him on one of the walks in my shanty neighborhood that I would try to actually read the book. So, you
know. Yeah, we'll find out if he actually does. He'll probably at least maybe try and listen to the audiobook if I can get one of those done.
Yeah, if you could stand the sound of your own voice, you could do it.
And if I could make a female voice, we'll see. I'm skeptical about
just
my ability.
Squeeze a little harder. Voice.
There are some things you can do with pitch shift, but yeah, who knows? Maybe there's some sort of audio plugin that'll do it. I don't know.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, we can try that. Well, thanks for joining us, folks. This has been the very first and probably last live episode of the Reed Rothbard podcast. Thank you for joining us. We've got books, lectures, articles, things you can buy at reedrothbard.com. We'll be having another episode next Friday as well. This one has been about Blazing Saddles and a bunch of other random crap. And
yeah.
Next one will be about In Time. So we'll try to watch that in between now and then.
And a bunch of other random crap.
Tons of random crap. That's what you come to know us for. So thank you for joining us.
Take care, everybody.
All right. Bye-bye.
Chipmunks.
C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.